So thank you, everybody, for joining our Ivy podcast episode today. Our guest today is Cindy Grace Miller. I had the pleasure of meeting Cindy Grace at the NGLCC conference this year in Las Vegas, and was drawn to her energy and passion for inclusion and inspired by her story. Cindy Grace is an author, speaker, international transgender consultant, LGBTQIA trainer, coach, and therapist. She is a woman who has lived a life of challenge and success. She has been through multiple major life transitions, including transgender transition and career transition. Cindy Grace's work specializes in increasing ROI and employee engagement with inclusion strategies and organizational authenticity. Welcome to the Ivy podcast, Cindy Grace.
Hey, thank you, Wynn.
So glad to have you. I love the conversations that we've been having so far. And as I told you, you let me know about your book on transition and started reading through that to help me understand how to be a better ally. And wanted to just talk with you more today about, you know, from a perspective of workplace belonging and HR leadership, like what should we know? What can we do to educate ourselves better so we can be better? We can be better allies and provide inclusion. One of the first questions I had for you was on stigma. So as you and I both know, the mistreatment of transgender professionals in the workplace, it far outweighs other professional workplace discrimination incidents. With 1 in 4 transgender people reporting having lost their jobs due to bias, and more than 75% having reported experiencing some form of workplace discrimination, what can these workplace stigmas look like, and how can we tackle them to make space for inclusion?
Well, I think that's a good question, because there's a couple of sides to the issue as I see it. Because one, I think as a person who transitioned or is transgender, the expectations that we bring into a corporate culture or into a company culture really does have weight as to how we respond to and perceive what's going on as far as other people's stigmas. So we have to personally take responsibility for that. And I'm not sure that we don't talk about that as much, but I like to talk about that because, you know, I bring a perspective. And if I expect you to be XYZ and you're not, then I feel like you have a stigma against you, me, and maybe you do, maybe you don't. But I never gave you a chance. Now, there are plenty of stigmas when it comes to transgender. And I think that that's largely due to just a lack of education. You know, this, what we know about being transgender is so new. And by new, I mean in the last 20 years, maybe 10 to 20 years, that before that, all of human history, even if we had a sense of maybe, okay, yeah, there's two spirits, that kind of, as a whole, humanity just didn't have a place for transgender or non-binary or gender fluid. None of our corporate cultures, none of our gender structures, nothing was built with a place for that. So of course, people have stigmas, because they've never actually been educated as to what's really going on. And what happens is, at least what I've observed, is that we have a couple of things going on. One, people still think about transgender like they used to think about being gay, and that is that it's a choice, that it's a preference. Well, I don't want to be male anymore. I want to be female. And therefore, it's easy to villainize a choice. Well, I don't agree with the choices that they're making. When you begin to learn the medical side, which I do a lot of education and teaching on, you realize, okay, it's not a choice whether you are transgender. The choice is how you live that, whether you reveal it. You know, I like to say, you don't really transition your gender, you reveal your gender. And so when somebody comes out in a workplace environment, they're revealing something that is going to challenge what the majority of their coworkers have been educated to think when it comes to gender. And then you have to throw on top of that gender roles. And so men and women, up until what, the last 30 years, 40 years, have had very firm gender roles throughout a lot of cultures. And now we're saying, okay, we're actually identifying that, boy, these aren't healthy. So let's take somebody like me. If I were working as what, you know, my past life when I was pretending to be male, and all of a sudden I show up as female, if I get what I was working for, and I've had this conversation with a lot of women of trans experience, and people actually see you as female. Well, now you have to deal with how people treat women or how men disregard women. And you have a whole nother batch of stigmas in addition to being transgender. And so you kind of have to, there's a lot of hurdles, so to speak, a lot of obstacles that you have to be prepared to kind of jump over. But largely, I think it just comes down to if we talked about it more, because I tell people that, you know, 90 to 95% of the world never thinks about being transgender. They don't think of transgender people. I realize we, you know, if you're in the community or you're in HR, you think about it because it's at the forefront of you know, hot topic points and things like that. But most people don't until it's suddenly there in their face in one way or the other, whether it be a political thing, a social thing, a family member. And then the only thing that they have to pull on is their history, which from an education standpoint has been poor for most of us, right? I mean, I have to say, I had the same health class as everybody else. And we weren't taught to have a sense of what transgender really was. And so it does, it provides a lot of stigmas that people don't even realize they have. And that's the other thing. Most of your coworkers, they don't realize they have these stigmas until you show up. And that's why if we can create some corporate environments that educating about this is just normal, kind of like we have started to do over the last 10 to 20 years on women's rights. I mean, we still have a long way to go, but, biracial issues in the workplace and opportunities, things like that. It's becoming, there's a long way to go, but it's a lot better than it was. And I think the same thing just needs to happen around what is transgender, people who are transitioning, how do they fit within our company culture?
Well, and I mean, exactly. And to your point, you know, one of the things that I think that we don't, I love that you say we don't talk about it enough because we don't. But to even name, you know, the types of discrimination, like what does that discrimination look like? One of the terms we use a lot in our field is microaggressions. And microaggressions are those slight, not overt insults or snubs at a person or a group of people based on their representation. And I think, you know, it's important to name what those microaggressions towards transgender professionals can look like. And it can be things like moving away from someone when they're sat next to you at work, refusing to use correct pronouns, or what we call dead naming. What other kind of things that can you think of? I think it's just important to talk about them so that people they can recognize even when they're doing them unconsciously.
Oh, sure. And like I said, I think that comes back to education too, because sometimes these microaggressions are intentional. I think a lot of times they're not.
Right.
They're a default, I guess you could say, that somebody is operating by. So you're right. They're not even aware that they're doing this. And then if I come at it with a hypersensitivity to any kind of microaggression, I'm going to respond. And I think there's a balance in there where we educate the cis community to say, hey, there are a lot of things that can make somebody feel uncomfortable that you're not aware of. So we're going to make you aware of them. And also to the trans community to say, it's okay not to be so super sensitive. You don't always have to call everybody out all the time. Because who wants to live that way? Even though I know a lot of people who do, and that's a choice. So it's kind of finding that bottom line, but it could even be things like where they just ask you about, hey, have you had surgery? Right? Some people consider that to be a microaggression or, you know, things like that. And within the trans community, you don't have one way of thinking about these kind of things. Like somebody can ask me about surgeries all day long. I don't consider that aggressive. I consider that curious. I'm happy to talk with them and educate them. Somebody else, so like my child who's trans, would find that extremely offensive and it would shut down. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's going to vary a lot. And that's one of the things that I think makes it really difficult for HR departments and companies as they try to navigate this, because they're like, oh my gosh, I don't know where to step.
Yeah. Well, and I think what's unique in your role is, you know, in your role as an educator, those types of questions, you know, it is more common as those questions come your way because you've taken on that position as an educator to educate others on what it is like to transition and what to think about for transition. One of the things that I was taught, I like this analogy, maybe not analogy, but I like this process when someone has asked the question too, is like, are we allowed to ask about anatomy? And my response to that is, unless you are planning on being intimate with a person, asking about their anatomy is not appropriate. So unless you're in that situation, where you're planning on being intimate, you shouldn't be asking, except for in a area where you are with someone who is an educator of this topic, like yourself.
I think I'm going to push you though, and I'm going to push your audience just a little bit here.
Yeah.
Because part of what I do is I like to kind of push on some of these issues, because here's the thing. Okay. As a woman with my girlfriends, guess what? We look at other women's boobs and we think about them and we think about other body parts and we talk about sex and we, you know, these are normal things and we're not going to be intimate with one another, but we still think about it. And so I think that there is a bit of normality there. And I can tell you that guys do too.
Yeah.
There is a bit of normality of just thinking, okay, wow. You know, what about, you know, those gender organs, so to speak, as we like to frame them. Now, I agree that if you're obsessed with my body parts and we're not intimate, then we need to kind of deal with that because you've got other issues. But to simply bring it up occasionally, it's more normal than I think we give it people credit for. It really is. It's just part of our life. And so I think what we need to teach people is, hey, this may seem normal to you, but you need to be a little extra sensitive with somebody who's in the middle of a transition, you know? And I might have been way more sensitive. I tell people all the time, I've had surgeries and I have boobs. I didn't always. So when I first started, I may have been way more sensitive than I am now. Right. So it's more of teaching people that, hey, you're not a bad person because you think about what somebody has between their legs. We all do. Let's just be frank. But you need to learn to be sensitive in ways that maybe you were never taught, or maybe you were never aware. It's kind of like, let's talk about racial stuff. I grew up in the country in North Florida where there were racial things that happened that we didn't realize we're even racial.
Right.
Right. Nobody was thinking that way, thinking less of this color of person's skin or this, but it was happening all around us. And at some point you have to get educated and go, ooh, this may not. Yes, I wasn't thinking of them as less of a person, but maybe this isn't appropriate. And I need to check myself a little bit here. And so and that's where it comes back down to that, just that education of going, where we talk about it so much. I mean, I remember the 80s and 90s and 70s when being gay, if when I thought about gay people back then, and I was little, I was raised in a culture, and I think this was a largely Western culture, that gay people were like the deviants. Now, so not true, but
right.
That was the culture, right? And then what happened? And then they begin to think of them as there's something wrong with them, right? Not true, but that was the thought pattern until we started talking about it, until we start good representation. We started realizing, well, they're just like everybody else. Then all of a sudden, a lot of those stigmas kind of just dropped down by the wayside, but we had to talk about it a lot. We had to educate. And I think for companies, if they want to head off stigmas, they have to constantly have this, just like they do about things that are sexually inappropriate, right? That's pretty standard in HR departments now and company cultures.
That is.
Places for all races and all genders, that's pretty standard. We talk about it all the time, and we slowly start to see changes. We have to kind of see the same thing happen. And then I think stigmas they'll begin to just drop away.
I agree, completely agree. Thank you for that. Well, and I mean, kind of going a little bit more into that. So, you know, with the stigma and discrimination becomes, barriers for trans professionals in the workplace. And according to the Human Rights Campaign and the Trevor Project, there are about 4.2 million transgender or gender expansive people in the United States. And while part of the greater LGBTQIA community, the needs for gender diversity different from the needs for attraction diversity. So who you are versus who you love, your needs are different. Can you talk more about some of the barriers to inclusion that the trans community faces in the workplace?
Yeah, well, I think what you kind of hinted at this a little bit, or you were leading me into it, but I think one of the biggest barriers is that transgender, you're right, it's not just who you go to bed with, which, by the way, hopefully you're not sleeping with people at work and during work hours. So your sexuality really doesn't come into play 9 to 5, so to speak, but your gender is always with you. And so when somebody decides that it's time for them to be authentic and to reveal to the world their true gender and live that, they can't choose to leave that in the bedroom, right, or the kitchen, depending on how you work, but they can't choose to leave that somewhere. They have to come with it all day, every day, in everything that they're doing. And so that provides a lot more hurdles that they have to learn how to get over. It's one of the reasons why I've started to try to educate corporations that you really need somebody like me who's there to coach folks as they're doing this, because otherwise, how do they know when to take a hurdle, how to take a hurdle, which ones to really focus on? They don't. And so now they have to bring that mess into work, and they don't want that. You don't want that as a company. But that's definitely a much bigger barrier right there. And then I also think you have the fact that people still think, and you alluded to this, they still think of transgender in a sexual way. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with sexuality or anything like that. But that's a community consciousness that is still there largely. And we tend to villainize sometimes what we consider to be alternative sexuality. And so if they see transgender that way, oh, that throws up a barrier right there, even mm-hmm. though it really has nothing to do with it. Then you have unequal gender roles, which we still fight with. So like I was mentioning earlier, if I'm coming out transgender and somebody's trans feminine, they not only have the fact that they have to bring it with them to work every day, they have the perceived that it's somehow sexual in nature, but they also have now having to deal with all of the barriers that women have to deal with. Mm-hmm. Right. So it puts all of these barriers in their way, and all they want to do is come to work and do the best job that they can.
Well, and exactly to your point, you know, the interesting thing is to your point, like trans feminine versus trans masculine, studies show that individuals who are trans feminine, they have reported that they have seen in the workplace less responsibility, less promotion, and less trusted with task and responsibilities after they transition. and those that are that transition female to trans masculine tend to be listened more. And it's not, I think we make that a trans issue, but that's really a masculine feminine construct issue. Like, yes. I love the way you put it, because I think so often we've been saying trans women experience giving less responsibility and less, but in reality, the way you state it is that they experience the issues that women deal with because they are women.
Exactly. And especially if you get what you want and people actually see you that way, then you're going to have to deal with that. So you overcome one set of barriers, and then boom, you have these next ones. And so what I would tell anybody who's listening or watching this, if they're transgender, but this, I would tell this to HR departments, et cetera, just like any woman on the planet, you just have to show up better prepared and ready to go. You know, and this was highlighted to me. And just the other day, I belong to a club where I play golf a lot. And there's a lot of great women and we hang out and everything's wonderful. But I've noticed, because I played golf for 30 plus years. So I've played with all men and all women, et cetera. And one of the things I've noticed is that the men, by and large, don't think about me. They don't give me the time of day. They could care less about me or anything until I have the opportunity to show up on the course with them. And then if I can show up and perform, then they either are impressed and they'll give me the time of the day, or they're scared because they just don't know what to do with someone who's better than they are. And so you get one of those two reactions, but they're not necessarily going to invite it. You have to be prepared to show up and be good at whatever it is you do. So I think this translates into the workplace. If you're going to do it, you better damn well be good at what you do. And I think women have known this forever, but so often it's so easy just to take a back seat and settle. And I would say, no, you can't settle. So if you're a woman of trans experience, yes, first, your first goal is to overcome just transitioning and revealing your true authentic self to the world. But then you've got to pull your panties up and really get to work by making sure you're competent at what you're doing.
Absolutely. And, you know, and to your, and just, I'm always blown away by the things that we talk about when I get to speak with you, and it's just such a wealth of knowledge. You know, moving into, like I had mentioned, a lot of our listeners are in the HR field and HR leaders. And as you and I both know, the needs of trans professionals it's not just all about bathrooms. It goes beyond that. And it involves policies, healthcare, education, employee support, but they're not cookie cutter approaches.
Oh, no. Yeah.
What do our HR leaders need to know about how to support their transgender employees?
Well, I think one of the first things, as far as HR goes, you need an accurate assessment. And this is probably the biggest thing that is lacking. They think they're better equipped. So you're either HR thinks they're better equipped than they are, or the CEO, the management team thinks they're better equipped. Oh, we're good at that. We're okay. And they're going to feel that way until they're not, until an issue or a person or something comes up, and then it's too late. And so having somebody like me to come in and really take an accurate assessment of the health of what's going on. And it's no different than when you go to the doctor and you think you're okay, and you realize, oh, I'm not okay. And my cholesterol is through the roof, and this is, and that, and you realize, okay, you have a wake-up call. I think a lot of companies need a wake-up call, but the only way they're going to have that is an accurate assessment of knowing, you know, what should we really be working on? Because my guess is they're focused on doing what it is that they do as a company, and they're not focused on this. They're not thinking about this. In fact, most would rather not think about this if they're honest, because let's face it, a company is designed to be a well-oiled machine, right? It's designed to make profits, to make a product, to make a service, and to work. And all of a sudden, when somebody comes in and they're transgender, like, the fear is they're going to mess up the well-oiled machine. This is now a complication. How do we deal with this? And they have to stop looking at their people as complications and start looking at them as people and assets. Because when you unleash a transgender person in their full authenticity, you actually speed the machine up rather than slow it down. But there's a process to do that, and it starts with an accurate assessment, for sure. Another thing is, we already talked about this, but it's just that constant education, not making it, you know, this is what I see a lot of companies do. June comes, right? Trans Awareness Month. And they do all kinds of stuff about transgender or, you know, gay or this or that. And then it's back to business. I go, this should be just, it should be in your guidelines. It should be in your regular meetings. It should just be a regular piece, almost in small doses rather than big doses, mm-hmm. Where it's just everywhere and it becomes part of the company culture, where we just educate, and kind of talk about that. And then also we educate our employees by saying, we're not happy if you're coming to work inauthentic. And most don't do that. Most say, hey, if you need to come out, we support you. That's a different way of saying it that I don't think is as effective as saying, no, we don't even want you to be part of this organization unless you are 100% you. Mm-hmm. That's what we want. Now you start doing that and you teach it to your management team, to your C-suite employees, all the way down to your base level workers. Now you're going to create a company culture of authenticity. And people are just going to go, yeah, well, of course we want Wynn to be Wynn. That's what we want. We don't want Wynn to be something else. And so it'll just be a natural thing because authenticity goes way beyond just gender, right? I mean, like, most people are not authentic. Most people have crutches that they've learned to depend upon to make their life work. And so, you know, creating a company of authenticity, it goes way beyond gender.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, support that's visible. You know, really not just saying in secret, okay, come here. We'll do this, this, and this. No, actually making it very visible to the entire employee base that we support transgender employees. And in fact, not only do we support them, but we don't do it begrudgingly. We support them excitedly. We're happy. We want them here. And I think the reason we don't do that is a lot of, let's say, C-suite level management, they don't fully realize what an asset a transgender person can be.
Right.
And they really are an asset. Mm-hmm. Because they, you know, what you have to go through, you develop immense amounts of insight and patience and compassion. And these are the characteristics you want in a leader. So I go, if you have somebody you want to almost find those transgender people and encourage them to come out, because you've got leaders in the making right there.
You know, for me, it's always been, you know, one for the LGBTQ community in general, but primarily for the trans community or the gender expansive community. Like, as a HR person, as a former recruiter, what I always admired was to see a group of people who have done the work to fully know who they are and live. Like, how many of us can say we really know who we are?
And oh, exactly.
We have ourselves. Like, that is, it's brave sounds cliche, but I can't think of the right word. You know, it's that, like, how do you not want to flock to that type of personality, that type of will and productivity of someone who is very confident in themselves, despite what the social norm tells you to be?
Oh, yeah. And you know what? I don't have the luxury to not be authentic. Right. Like, once you come out and you go down that path,
yeah,
it's all or nothing.
Yeah.
So I don't have that luxury. I go, I have to do it. So I'm going to do it well. But 100% of trans employees that I've ever spoken to after they've transitioned and they're living their life, 100% without any doubt, tell me they are more productive.
Mm-hmm.
and they are more committed to the company that they're at.
Yep.
And they just enjoy their job more and they produce more.
Yep.
What company wouldn't want that?
Right. Well, you know, one of the important things when it comes to workplace belonging and commitment, you know, to your earlier point, you know, sometimes I will hear managers say, well, why can't you just keep your attraction or who you love at home? Why do we need, as an organization, why do we ask that of our LGBTQ and trans community and not of our cis and hetero community? Because as an employee, as a coworker, you want to share your family with everyone. I mean, what do people do? What did you and I do before we got here? How was your weekend?
We're talking about life.
People want to talk about their life. And we hear reported often that LGBT report that they don't feel comfortable sharing their life because there's a bit of, you know, companies say, we support you being out and being here, but just don't share too much. But I want us to be here to tell companies, you've got to stop saying that. Like we have to feel comfortable to share, like, here's what, you know, so, you know, people can say, here's what my wife and I did. Here's what my girlfriend and I did. Here, you know, here's what we did with our kids. Like we want to share that just as the same as any family, any person wants to share that information.
Yeah. And I think it makes me think of the old adage, don't judge a book by its cover. Mm-hmm. You know, when you live in a world that is largely historically heteronormative, so to speak, as far as, let's just talk about 70% of the population, 80%, whatever. I mean, the LGBT population is huge, but there are still way more heterosexual individuals out there. You've got a lot of your traditional models. And so they don't know what to do with. I almost say it's not like they hate. They just don't know what to do with it. It's not part of what they have been trained. And then some, unfortunately, are trained to dislike. So you definitely get part of that. But, you know, it's tough, not just for them. It's tough for us, too. I mean, I deal with this. So I'm married. We've been together a long time, and I transitioned in my marriage. So I'm married to a woman. And as I transitioned, we both realized that neither one of us is lesbian. We're not gay. I'm not. She's not. Mm-hmm. But we also knew that what we had built, our relationship, the emotional intimacy, everything else that we have, we didn't want to throw that away because of just this one thing. Right. So we have a marriage that does not meet the norm. But if I tell people, yeah, this is my wife, what do they instantly think?
They assume lesbian.
Yes, I think that. And then I've watched them. So I have a lot of conservative friends where they're all heteronormative. I think sometimes they if they don't know, they think of me as the token. Like, oh, I have my lesbian friend, right? until they get to know me a little better, then they might realize that's not the case. But and so it's like, well, I don't want to go into a whole dissertation onto why I'm not lesbian and why I'm married to a woman and all this stuff. But at the same time, if we're all talking about spouses, I want to be able to talk about my spouse without them thinking, you know, that I might do this or that in the bedroom.
Right.
And that's a tough juggling act for both them and me. And that's part of why we just need to talk about it more. So we can realize that we're all just trying to do this together. So let's find a way to do that. And if somebody's not willing to, you don't have to associate with them.
Yeah.
Right. You will find plenty of people that do want to enter into that conversation and realize that, oh, okay, this looks a little different.
Yeah. And I love that. I mean, it's the more we normalize it, the more it becomes part of that bubble of understanding. You know, as by human nature, we try to put others in a category that our brains understand. And that's where that frustration and that what we call social identity theory comes from, is people they're trying to figure out, where do you fit in the society that I know, so I know how to interact with you.
Exactly.
But if if they don't know about this section of society that they've not been trained about, then, you know, brain confusion. So we're expanding knowledge. So they go, oh, okay, I get it. I get where this.
And it really has to come from the top down.
Right.
Right. Because it's one thing to say, we're going to teach this to our new employees or whatever. But if the management doesn't see this, mm-hmm. you know, if the unfortunately largely white male management level, if mm-hmm. they don't see this and live it, it's never going to really permeate the corporate culture.
Speaking of that, I learned two really neat phrases earlier this week. And it was about employee readiness for leadership change and organizational change. And basically, when it comes to employee commitment, there are two types of employee commitment. There is what's called continuous commitment. And that is individuals who have invested so much in the company, they'll stay because it costs too much to go. And then there are individuals that they call effective commitment. And those are people who have an emotional attachment to your organization. So they are down with the values and the mission and the goal, and they're staying because they believe in the mission. And the studies show that as an organization, you want more employees with the effective commitment than the continuance commitment. And I could see, you know, even in the transgender community, I could see where if they're, you know, employees can tend to be stuck more on the continuance commitment because, you know, I can stay and I can have a job, but I'm not bought into this company because we're not jiving on workplace belonging. And so it's like, I really feel it's a mission for leadership is like, don't take a look at those continuance employees, that commitment as great, I have them. You kind of reluctantly have those people. How do you change their attitude? How do you match the values to make more and more employees have that effective commitment?
And it really comes down to the leadership. Mm-hmm. Standing up for, in this case, the trans community, standing up for those people who aren't being stood up for, and they will be very allegiant to you. I tell the story of when I was in middle school. So I have to be honest with you. I've been around the block a few times. I don't remember hardly anybody from middle school or high school, to be honest with you. Definitely very few names. But there's this one name, Rob Musselman, that always, I could never forgot Rob. Now, you want to know why? Because in seventh grade, and I don't remember the details of the situation, but there were some boys picking on me, and Rob, I was new in the school. Rob was kind of part of the inner circle. He stepped in and said, cut it out, stood up for me, and basically squashed the whole thing. And to this, and Rob and I weren't necessarily best friends or anything like that. To this day, I don't know why he chose that moment to do that thing. But of all the people I've known, why does his name stick out to me? Because somebody stood up for me when I couldn't stand up for myself. Mm-hmm. And I think leadership of companies have the opportunity to be the Rob Musselmans in people's lives, to stand up for them and say, they have a place here. We've got your back. We're going to provide the resources. Because we don't want you to just be here because you need a job. We want you to be here because you believe in what we believe in.
Yeah.
And the more leadership does that, the better their company is going to be.
Absolutely. Completely agree. Shifting into healthcare, let's talk more about benefits.
Okay. So
most HR leaders are familiar with the term gender-affirming care, but I'm not sure many people know what that really means. We say it all the time, gender affirming care, but nobody really goes into the detail. I'd love for you to elaborate and knowing what I know that you run a healthcare company for several years, elaborate on what we mean by gender affirming care and what should organizations be looking for in their healthcare options?
Okay. So yeah. And so for our listeners, I've been a health insurance broker for a little over 12 years. And before I came out, that was something that I did. And I still have that company and still work somewhat in the employee benefits world. And, you know, gender affirming care is, and I'm going to speak specifically just for adults, because that's what we're going to be dealing with in our companies. It's much more varied than most people realize. Most people go to either hormones or surgery, and that's definitely part of it. And to be honest with you, any health insurance policy that falls under the Affordable Care Act is going to have some coverage for hormone therapy, whether it be male or female, as well as various surgeries, not all of them. Because here's the thing, health insurance companies by and large are for-profit companies. And so they always ask, is it medically necessary? And they're really scared to cover something where they're going to lose their shirt, as any company would be. And so a lot of people go, why do I have to jump through all these hoops? Well, because they, just like anybody else, they want to make sure that it's really medically necessary. Now, I have to be honest with you, with the surgeries that we get, nobody would want it unless it's medically necessary. That's just ignorance, honestly. They don't understand the extreme nature of what we go through. And so part of that is educating leaders and companies. And I think educating the masses that when somebody transitions, let's just talk about somebody who has, everybody thought they were male, but they're female. And so now they have to try to make their physical body look more like their true authentic gender. Often they have to go through years of laser or electrolysis on their face. So hormones take care of most of the body hair, but unfortunately, testosterone poisoning causes a lot of the hair growth on the face to be permanent without something like electrolysis or laser. Most insurance policies don't cover that. They see it as cosmetic rather than medically necessary. So this is where I would say, you know, look for a policy that does cover that, that's really trans-friendly. There's a few of them out there. Or if you have, some companies do self-funded plans, write that in, that we're going to help you cover, because it's really, it can be expensive, and you have to do it for a long time, depending on how much hair you have. And this is something a lot of people don't think of. Then you have voice training, and this differs from a lot of people, but just going to get voice coaching, I'm amazed how many people don't do it because they can't afford to. And just providing some help there with an insurance, but most do not cover that as well. There are a few, so that's something you can look into. So for your, whoever your employee benefits teams are, when you're looking at what kind of policy, these are some things that you would look at, because most are going to cover your estrogen therapy or your testosterone blockers or your testosterone. They're going to cover that kind of stuff largely, but they're not going to cover some of these other things. They're going to probably cover what we call gender confirmation surgery, which is down below. They're probably going to cover breast augmentation, if, as long as the doctor says this is part of the diagnosis and medically necessary, but not always. So you need to pay attention, especially self-funded plans where a company actually sets what they will and will not cover. So with a self-funded plan, you know, some companies might say, well, we're not going to cover infertility treatments. And in the same way, they might say, we're not going to cover transgender-affirming healthcare. And that's not a company you want to be part of, because they don't really want to support you, and they see it as superfluous as opposed to necessary for their employee base. So you kind of want to look at some of these kind of things of what we're dealing with. And then also just general therapy and coaching, having somebody who that person can work with. And this is where you alluded to earlier, that this goes way beyond bathrooms and name tags and emails. That's all fine and dandy, but then somebody has to navigate the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and having either a therapist or a coach that can come alongside them and give them the support they need is huge. And sometimes they can't afford that. And so making that part of your benefit package can be huge. And there, you just have to do a little extra legwork to put that together for your employees. But honestly, the companies I know who have done that, who take the time to construct a benefit program that really supports their trans employees and their LGBT employees as a whole, they have way better employee satisfaction and employee commitment.
Absolutely.
Hands down.
Absolutely.
And so healthcare is a huge, and there's no employer on the planet who doesn't realize that healthcare is central to how they run their business. Mm-hmm. And yet it's amazing how many still don't pay enough attention to it, but they should pay a lot more attention to issues such as gender affirming care for sure.
Hmm. Well, and I really appreciate you going through that. In the past few years, I've heard so much in the HR community about a gender affirming care, but I've never heard anybody talk in detail about what that means. And I was like, why aren't we talking about it? Why aren't we being specific? So that way everybody knows what they're asking for and that they know what to ask the benefit brokers for. And they know
all of the HR people and companies just, if they get a copy of my book, I actually go through all of the things that are required. And I remember after I wrote it and I was proofreading the book and I'm looking at this and I go, holy crap, did I do all that? And I did. And, you know, you just do a little bit at a time. But most people, if they're not part of knowing somebody who's transgender or being transgender, they're not going to realize how much goes into it. And so I would encourage them to get the book, to read it, to have it available for their employees, because it's going to just broaden their mindset as to what's really happening when somebody transitions. And we're just talking about somebody who is 100% healthy mentally and physically. Mm-hmm. Now let's take an employee who's not 100% healthy mentally and physically. All of the things we just talked about get exasperated. There's more things that have to be dealt with. And if you have a company with lots of employees, that falls under your purview.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a member of the LGBTQ community, but an ally of the trans community. I didn't know half of what we went through. And as I read through that part of your book, it was one of those things where I never even thought about those areas. But as soon as I read especially about, you know, how to take care of the facial hair, and I was like, it made so much sense, but I never thought to question that's a step that you have to go through. Of course you have to go through that. But yeah.
It takes forever.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It really does.
I can imagine.
So definitely paying attention to that gender affirming and just knowing what it is, I think is a huge step for a company.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you again for our time today and helping to continue the conversation of workplace belonging for the trans population. For organizations or individuals wanting to know more, how do they get to work with you?
Well, they can go to CindyGraceMiller.com. So I try to make it really easy, CindyGraceMiller.com. And they can read all about kind of what we do and who I am. And they can reach out to me via email, which is usually the best way. You know, in this day and age, phone calls don't work as quickly as email, honestly. And so my email is right there on the website, but they can always email me at Cindy@CindyGraceMiller.com. They can start by getting a copy of my book. And yes, I'm going to hawk it because this isn't just some novel. I wrote this to be of an assistance to people transitioning. So for people listening or if you're watching, it's called Gender Transition, Where to Start and How to Thrive. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Japanese Amazon, European, I mean, it's all over. Gender Transition, Where to Start and How to Thrive. And just like the title says, I wrote this to be a roadmap. I don't deal with every possible thing that might come up because that book would be 10 volumes long, but I give a roadmap of this is what you have to look with, this is what you need to be thinking through, and I deal a lot with the emotional and psychological side of transitioning because I think that's really important to doing it well, and who wants to do something and not do it well? So definitely that, and then through my website and just through contacting me, We can customize something that works for the company. And that's one of the things that, I kind of pride myself on. I don't have a cookie cutter approach. So they go, well, tell us what your thing is. I can't tell you what my thing is because it's going to vary on your company culture. It's going to vary on your leadership culture. We're going to need to do an assessment first and see where you're at. What works for this company may not work for this company. They can also utilize me just for keynote if they have an event. One of the things that I love to do is simply to come in as a keynote speaker or lead a seminar for them or their management team. And just some of the things we just talked about now, kind of expand on that a little bit for their particular company, as well as designing trainings, whether they be trainings for company-wide, their HR department, their management team, their C-suite employees, helping them begin to assimilate all this information in a way that makes sense for their day-to-day operations.
Absolutely. And I couldn't have said it better. Diversity and inclusion is not a cookie cutter process. I wish more companies understood that. Absolutely not a cookie cutter.
Yeah, and I know it's easier. I know a lot of friends and other people who have these like set seminars and like workshops, and it's so easy to just to buy that service and have them come in, and now we rubber stamp it and think we've done it. But you haven't. You really need to take the time to customize it for your organization if you really want good results.
Yep.
And that takes a little bit of a commitment. So
absolutely wonderful. Again, Cindy Grace, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. I can talk about this all day if I have to. And then if you want to talk about something else, we can talk about that too.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.